This is Social Entrepreneur with Ava Kreichel of Glitch.
Learning specifically how to be a leader as a young woman of color in a predominantly white male space. There are less than 3% of women who are C-suite executives and business owners, and even less of them are women of color.
Welcome to Social Entrepreneur. My name is Tony Lloyd. I'm a former Fortune 500 executive, but today I spend my time with changemakers who are making an impact in the world. Each week you'll hear exciting stories of ordinary people just like you who are making a difference. They share their successes, their failures, and what they're learning along the way. Thanks for being with me today. Let's get started. Hi, and welcome to Social Entrepreneur. And today we're talking to Ava Kreichel of Glitch. Now, if you're hearing this intro music and you're wondering if you're in the right place, yes, the intro music is new, and there's a lot that's new, but that's thanks to you. Let's go back in time for a second and think about this. We've been working towards a radio program, and we ran a crowdfunding campaign in order to fund that. And thanks to you, we were successful with that crowdfunding campaign. So starting today, Monday, June 19th, we have a brand new radio program. It's found on AM 950 in the Twin Cities. And it's not the only thing that's new. So what's happening is we're putting out two episodes every Monday, because a radio program is an hour long, and so there are two halves to that. So we'll just continue to put out these as podcasts. So you continue to get episodes every Monday morning. There'll be two of them, and we have new music, we have a new schedule, but some things are going to remain the same. And one of the things that will remain the same is we're going to continue to talk to amazing change makers like Ava Kreichel, who are making an impact in the world. So Ava is the co-founder of Glitch, and Glitch promotes the exploration of digital games as culture, career, and creative practice. Ava is a very interesting person. She's a game designer, she's a neuroscientist, and an entrepreneur. So I was really interested to hear how a game designer and neuroscientist would approach designing and developing her business. But Ava's primary focus is she wants to support emerging game makers who are doing interesting and innovative work. She's really trying to transform the gaming industry. And so let's get right to this conversation with Ava. Here she is, Ava Kreichel of Glitch.
I think it really started out, for me at least, when I was in college. I, as a young person, even before college, I was an early adopter. I had a computer. I was in front of a computer by the age of four. I started doing things online, and I was really interested in building, not only building games, but also building websites. And I actually ended up selling Beanie Babies online for building websites.
Wait. I got to stop you. How old were you when you were selling Beanie Babies online?
I believe I was 10.
10. So you had like an e-commerce site, or you used eBay, or what did you do?
I just built a normal website, and I think it may have been GeoCities. I can't even remember at this point. but I had built a website, and I put a lot of the ones that I had online that I knew that were rare, did some research, threw it up there. And my parents actually didn't believe me when the first sale was around $1,000 until the checks came in. And another thing that I kind of got into was building bizarre battle simulators online in AOL chat rooms. Yeah. So I was really interested in not only games, but also everything that had to do with digital. Interestingly enough, as I grew up, my parents really pushed me towards being either a doctor or a lawyer, and those seemed to only be my two options. Mm. So I kind of stepped a little bit away from technology to pursue that and did my degree in neuroscience. But you know, there's something missing. And I was searching and scouring the world really for information about games. And I knew I couldn't really leave my current university, especially with parents and my family being here. It really wasn't an option for me. And I tried to find people who were, you know, interested in games. That was kind of my first step. And I essentially couldn't find that here in Minnesota, specifically in Minnesota. I found some online resources, but I realized that there weren't a lot of resources and support out there for emerging game makers, unless you're currently enrolled in a program, which many people who are in the games industry actually didn't even, you know, go to school for games, because our industry is actually only, I think at this point, 60 years old. So I realized that there weren't support structures and there wasn't something for me to get involved in and for me to really kind of accelerate where I was to where I wanted to be. And so that was where the concept of Glitch first started. And so we built it here at the University of Minnesota.
And when you say we built it, mm-hmm. So what is the it that you built at University of Minnesota?
Really, programs. So we started launching programs. It started off with events and programming where we would have people who were from the industry come in and talk, give lectures, give workshops. And that's where it started.
Okay. And so when you say programs, you mean like a speaker program, somebody came in, yep. They gave a lecture, they were talking about the industry per se. Mm-hmm. You were a student at the time.
Yes, I was.
Yeah. And who helped you organize these?
It was essentially my peers, our other co-founder, Nick Van Meerten. And we really tried to understand, you know, what it was, if it was just us that needed this, were there other people? We were trying to also connect with other people. And we realized that after starting the first few events, that this was absolutely something that people wanted, young people like us. There were tons of people who were similar to us. And within the first year, I had received and was awarded my first $45,000 grant to actually continue doing the work that we were doing at the university.
Well, let me pause you for a second. Did students pay to come to this programming, or was this just sort of events that were part of the university?
So yes, we did have membership fees early on. I believe the first time we had rolled out membership fees, it was $15. And then we had membership fees that were semesterly, which was $45. And that also helped us essentially purchase some of the equipment that we couldn't have purchased from our pool of funding that we received.
Right. And
there's a lot of regulations on some of that type of grants.
Yeah.
Or some of those types of grants.
Yeah. And so the grants, how did you come up with the grant? I mean, did you just start rattling doors around the university saying, hey, can somebody help fund this? Or was there a grant application thing that you knew about already? Or how did you get your first grant?
Yeah, so it was a little bit of digging, and we tried to figure out, like, okay, well, obviously we're starting something that people are interested in, we're interested in, and, you know, we need supplies, we need tools, we need a lot of different things. What are our options for getting those? And so we searched a little bit, and also with an advisor through the student union, Hans, if Hans is listening, hello, he's amazing. We realized that there is many avenues actually of funding that are available on campus. And so we started pursuing them.
Yeah. Was a grant specifically for a program, or was it to just continue your gathering, or what was the grant
for? How does it work? Yeah. So what that was for was basically we proposed for the next year what we would be doing. So it was all program-based. So over the year, or at least the next fiscal year for the university, we had to map out exactly what it was that we were anticipating on doing, budgeting it all out, and asking them to see if they would fund it.
So you were doing programming at the university. Were you a senior at the time? Is that about
No, I was a sophomore.
A sophomore. So how did that tranche of money and that activity eventually become Glitch?
I guess at the time, it was already Glitch. We basically used the initial funds to kind of figure out what became our core programming, really, mm-hmm. as we had evolved and as we moved into being a full-fledged nonprofit. Mm-hmm. So that's really what that funding helped enable us to do, which was test out some of our theories. It was really kind of, you know, R&D budget, right? Mm-hmm. It helped us test out some more of our programs that we wanted to try and see if people were interested in what the impact was, actually. We had proposed so many things and we were funded for so much of it. But at the end of the day, when you look at Glitch, we've come down to three core programs. And that was how that grant really helped us kickstart the things that we were doing.
Do you yourself design games?
Yes. So, yeah, I definitely do. It's most of my background as I was going through the university, I actually started working with a lot of companies that were in the games space. So a lot of my experience was actually more on the publishing side, and I also started delving into some game design. Yeah. So I, with my neuroscience background, really focus on UX, and I also act as the creative director on all of our projects that we take with any partners or any of our game development projects. So yes.
Yeah, and when you were designing these programs then, as a person with a neuroscience background, as a person with a UX UI design background, as a design thinker, I guess you could say, how did you approach creating these offerings that you have today?
Very similar to how I approach game design. I started off, you know, with ideas. I started off looking at, you know, what people were interested in, what people wanted, what I wanted, and did that match? And then I would sit down and think about what types of programs make sense. Mm-hmm. And then we tested them. We got them out and we did small scales. We would put in, you know, maybe $500 towards a program for a semester and see if it took off. Was it something that people wanted? Was it something that people liked? Was it something that people were passionate about, whether they passionately loved it or they passionately hated it? And then we iterated off of the ones that we thought had the most promise.
Yeah.
So that's really, at the end of the day, how I approach program design and also how I approach game design.
Yeah. So you knew your target audience partially because you were your target audience,
and
right?
I still am at the end of the day, right? Yes, absolutely. I knew the target audience because myself and also my co-founder, we were the target audience.
Yeah.
But we wanted to make sure that it wasn't just us. It wasn't just him and I who were interested in this, and we weren't just designing things exclusively for ourselves.
And how important do you think that experimentation and feedback and iteration, how important do you think that has been for your success?
I think it's absolutely critical. I think as someone who is a maker, as someone who is a designer, I can only see what I see in the world and take my knowledge and really come up with something that I think is a potential solution. But as for how people are going to perceive my solution, how people are going to act or behave or use those solutions, I never truly can know. I can have guesses, but I never think that I know how people are going to act once they either play the game or they are involved with the program.
Right.
And that's, I think, the most powerful thing is going in open-minded, designing something that you think could be potentially great, and being open to taking that feedback to iterate off of your original design. Because sometimes, you know, even with games and programs, like, my initial ideas change very drastically and they aren't the same as when they started. And I think it's better at the end, you know, it's better for it because I learn about the small nuances. I learn about how people act or behave in a specific level, or I learn about how people act or behave when greeted at the front door. It's surprisingly important when on the first day when people are doing the immersion program, we play games together and we don't talk about a ton of the educational aspects of games. How do we allow people to be vulnerable and to talk about the issues that they're truly facing in games and why they're here to do the programs that we have? Things like that.
We believe, whether we're building a business or we're building a game, we believe that this is the end result that will happen, but games and businesses, they and behavior of users, they surprise you sometimes, don't they?
Oh, absolutely. The thing for all designers, if there are designers who are listening, but at the same time, I think social entrepreneurs are also designers, is that you really don't know what to expect. All you can do is put forth your design into the world and let people use it and iterate and continue iterating. I think everything you put out in the world should be a living thing, right? Especially if you're passionate about it. And for me, it's this organization, and it lives and it breathes, and there are people in so many different parts of it. And it just being open to, you know, maybe oftentimes hearing what you don't want to hear. That's super powerful, and I think that's where business is headed.
So when we think about users are going to behave in ways that we don't expect, you know, so far we've kind of talked about all the happy, joy part of going to, you know, you're in university and then somebody showered $45,000 on you and then you've been successful ever since, right? And I know sometimes business doesn't go the way you expect it to go, right? So can you talk about your journey a little bit? Has it all been sunshine and roses, or was there a place in there where it got pretty hard?
I think overall it's all been very difficult. I think at the end of the day, when I think about this question, the thing that was the hardest and continues to be the most difficult is really learning how to lead for me. Again, I was the age of 19 when I was awarded my first grant. It was a large sum of money, and at that time I was not leading, you know, employees. I was leading peers. And that's something that was very difficult. I had to learn how to distribute work. I had to learn how to motivate individuals who are working within the organization. Unlike, we were paid stipends, and I had essentially offered stipends. But at the same time, they are still my peers, and everyone who was working in this space was a peer. Learning how to hire, and then even just a year later, learning how to fire. And again, peers. And I think even like a decade later now, almost a decade later, I'm still learning how to lead every single day, learning how to build a board and leading that board and needing to figure out how to run it just like a boss, right? I've also been thinking a lot about like learning specifically how to say yes and oftentimes how to say no. Finding partners and learning how to find the right partners that have values that align with our organization and our mission, learning how to listen, learning how to seize opportunities. I mean, I think at the end of the day, and I think the most important one too, learning specifically how to be a leader as a young woman of color in a predominantly white male space. There are less than 3% of women who are C-suite executives and business owners, and even less of them are women of color. So for me, learning how to lead has been by far the most difficult thing, especially when I don't see others out there who are like me.
Well, that's a powerful, powerful statement right by itself. I mean, we could do an entire program just on that topic. When you think about the impact you'd like to have as an organization, how do you define that?
Man, I think right now even it's still a little amorphous, but to me, for us, I want to support emerging game makers who are doing interesting and innovative works. And what that means is really so open for interpretation based on our team and our values. And that's what I see. I want to make a change in this space. And I knew, you know, at the age of 20, maybe even 21, that currently this space isn't something that I want to go into in a traditional way. I love games. I don't love where games are right now. And I think personally that Glitch's goal is to be able to fund and also support emerging game makers who will make a change and make a difference in this space.
Yeah. And are you thinking that you want to try to target diverse game makers, people that we don't normally see or don't always see as being in the industry?
I think that at the end of the day, I'm very interested in looking at projects that are from people of diverse backgrounds. But at the same time, I'm also really interested in just people who are doing interesting work, right? Yeah, and I bet exactly. that at the same time, like, those probably are not mutually exclusive.
Right. Yeah. So, that's a really good point. You know, if you're looking for people who are approaching problems in a different way, if you're looking for people who are producing works that maybe nobody else has thought of, that have an energy, if you will, that's different than what you see in a lot of games, then you're going to be, by nature, by supporting that kind of work, you're going to be supporting that kind of people.
Yep. So I think it's all about emerging game makers for me. Yeah. And that's what Glitch is here to do, which is support emerging game makers who are doing interesting, fun, innovative things. And we're going to support the hell out of them.
All right. I'm going to switch to advice for early stage social entrepreneurs. And you rattled off a lot of things that you're learning on your journey just a few minutes ago. So when you think about something that you've learned, what's one or two pieces of advice that you would just pass on?
The biggest piece of advice is just to be bold. To be daring, and to find a community that you're specifically passionate about, find a problem that you're itching to solve, and jump in and shut it down. You know, like that's my piece of advice.
Jump in and shut it down. Oh, I'm gonna have t-shirts made with that. When I started to just ask you how people can find you online or on social media, but we haven't given you a chance to name the kinds of offerings that you have as a company. So let's just real quickly, when people go to your website and you know, you can mention what that is, what are some of the offerings you're going to find there?
Sure. So you can visit our website at www.glitch.mn. Some of the things that you'll find on there are our programs. So we currently have three programs that are listed. We have the Immersion Program, we have the Power Leveling Program, and we also have our residency program here at our office. And then we also host two annual events, Glitch Connect, which is our annual digital games festival here in Minneapolis, and GameCraft, which is tied in with the Global Game Jam, which is a 48-hour game jam. You get together with some people over 48 hours, you build a game.
That is amazing.
It's so amazing. And that program, like Global Game Jam, is its own nonprofit, and they do some really exciting, interesting work. I think every single year during Global Game Jam, last year there were over 9,000 9,000 games that were made. I don't really remember the statistics, but it's really neat. And you'll also find some information about our studio, which we work with a bunch of partners and a series of partners to build games. And how it fits into our mission is we actually ensure that 50% of our teams are actually emerging game makers who may have never shipped a title or who are specifically there to learn. And by the end of it, they'll actually have a title that they can put on their resume that, you know, they've made and they've worked on. And that's something that's really important to us, especially on a local level, because unfortunately here in Minneapolis, there aren't a ton of opportunities for people to find paid work who is an emerging game maker with maybe, you know, less than 5 years of experience.
Yeah. Very good. Well, I hope people will check out your site, and it's glitch.mn as in Minnesota, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then a call to action. People have been hanging out with you and me for a while now. What's something you would like to see them go and do as a result of this conversation?
I would like to encourage individuals to really find something that they're passionate about and go out and do something. I've met too many people. I've met too many individuals who are, you know, unfortunately stuck at a job that they don't love, at a position that they hate, or, you know, in an environment that they're not motivated or stimulated by. And being a social entrepreneur and being an entrepreneur who's working in a field that, you know, she absolutely loves, like, I look forward to coming into work every single day. I look forward to working with the people that are here. I look forward to working with all of our partners that, you know, I've worked so hard to find. And it's really a joy. And I think that's something that I hope everyone can find, which is enjoyment and fulfillment out of your job.
That's great. Well, Ava, thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, right. Thank you for having me.
And thanks to you, the listener, for joining us today. You are the reason that we produce Social Entrepreneur every Monday. You can find the show notes, bonus material, and more at tonyloyd.com. That's TonyLoyd.com. And while you're at it, will you do me a favor? Subscribe, rate, and review this podcast on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. It really helps others to find these stories of change makers who are making a difference in the world. Well, listen, thanks so much for joining me today. And until next time, please remember to use this one short, amazing life and go make an impact. Thanks. We'll talk to you next time on Social Entrepreneur.